This is Sign Language with Bruce Williams and Doc Goldstein.
Hi, and welcome to episode 175 of Sign Language. This is Bruce Williams from signlanguagepodcast.com.
And Doc Goldstein.
From sunny Los Angeles in California. How's the weather over there?
And it is sunny. It's hot. It's been hot for about 2 months now, and I'm tired of it.
I was going to say, you should be heading into autumn now, right? Or fall, as you would call it.
Well, that would be nice because it would, you know, my electric bill would go down for sure.
Yeah, right. You're nowhere near the fires, are you?
No, happily.
Yeah.
A few years ago, there was a fire behind the house, and you know, and it got kind of scary. We almost got evacuated, but we didn't at the last minute.
Right.
But no, this time we're not near the fires, so okay. It's all good.
Yeah, right. I think it's all anyway. Further up near Santa Barbara, isn't it? The ones that I've been hearing about lately?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel bad for everybody up there, and I have friends who live that way, so
yeah, right.
It's not good, you know.
Yes. Well, lots has happened since we last spoke. I think the last time we spoke, I was just about to head off and do a week of fill-in at a radio station in Sydney. I don't know if we spoke about that or not.
And, no, I don't remember that.
Oh, okay. So I was going to go and do a week for it's actually called Sky Racing Radio. It's the radio station that carries all of the horse racing. And it's not only Australia. They cover American horse races and all sorts of stuff. And so all the, you know, addicted gamblers listen to this radio station nonstop. I went off there to do a week of freelance work. That must have been, I'm going to say early August or mid-August. And I was meant to be going back there to do a five-week block from the middle of September through to late October. And on the second last day that I was there, so on the Thursday, I got a phone call from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which is our national broadcaster, saying, would you be interested in 4.5 months of freelance from now through to the end of the year?
Well, duh.
Yeah. So as much as I hated doing it, because I've always, like whenever I've been freelancing, I've always taken the approach, the minute I've locked in with somebody and said that I'll be there, then that stands. That's, you know, signed in blood, you know.
Right.
And I had to turn around to them and say, look, guys, I am really sorry, but on this occasion, I've got to take this because, you know, I've not had solid work for, at that stage, it was, you know, 8 or 9 months. And the prospect of 4.5 months of solid pay was just not something I could turn my back on. So
I'm sure they understood that.
They did. They did. And I said to the guy that I was filling in for, I said, look, I will do everything I can to find you an equally competent freelance engineer who can take over that five-week block that I was going to look after for you, because I feel bad that I've, you know, pulled the rug out from under your feet. So I haven't actually spoken to him. I'm hoping he's found someone, because I sent a couple of different people to him. So I'm hoping that at least one of those guys was able to take the work on and handle that five-week window for him. So,
well, you probably know all the radio engineers in your area, having been in that business for so long. You probably
exactly.
know every one of them.
Exactly. Yeah, and the first couple of guys that I rang both said to me, oh, mate, I'm doing freelance at the ABC. So I'm now seeing those guys on a daily basis. So I've been at the ABC for about 3 or 4 weeks now. And yeah, we'll be there at least until the end of the year.
That's great.
Yeah, the guy that I'm filling in for has been seconded off to another role where he's traveling around the country and overseeing the rollout of new software at all of the ABC studios around the country. And I spoke with him a couple of weeks ago, and he said, oh, mate, we're going to be going at least until the end of February, probably mid-March at least. So there's quite likely that come the end of the year, they're just going to say to me, can you keep coming back? Because we need you for a bit longer. So,
well, what kind of software is it? Is it like radio automation software or something like that?
Oh, the thing that he's rolling out is the, Yes, it's the Playout software that is used in the on-air studios, but it's actually quite a lot more than that. It's the database that holds all of the pre-recorded audio for every radio network, for some of the TV stuff, and it's got very basic editing, audio editing tools built into it as well. And so, so he's rolling that out around the country. In the meantime, I'm at his workstation running Pro Tools 12, not HD. That's fun and games. So they've said to me, look, you can use Reaper if you want, but we don't have a license. So you would either need to install your own copy on, you know, our computers or bring your own laptop with you. So I just went, stuff it. I'll work with Pro Tools. You know, it wouldn't hurt me to get up to speed on it.
Wow. alert the media, you know. So does Reaper use an iLock for its authorization?
No, it doesn't.
I see.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of iLocks. I found them very complicated to work with. But these days, not many people are using iLocks in the industry anyway. Most are just using Waves Central, you know, as the means through which to install the plugins and then authorize the plugins. You know, all the authorization can now be done through Waves Central.
Well, I was thinking about the Pro Tools authorization, not the plugins. But I think you can go on the cloud now and not have to use an iLock for Pro Tools as well.
Right.
You know, and that makes sense. The cloud makes sense for so many things, especially since the way it's all backed up and geographically separated and, you know, all that happy stuff. So it's great.
So what's been happening in your world in the last 3 months?
Well, I've just been so busy. It's just unbelievable, you know.
Right.
And I'm having a great time. You know, I've been teaching and it's great. You know, it really is.
So you're still teaching in two locations?
I am, yeah. And, awesome. And the students are fantastic. They really are, you know.
Excellent.
I was teaching earlier today, and I forgot what time it was. The students were so good, and the quality of their work is really good. So it's great. You know, awesome. I really do like it. So
fantastic.
And, you know, once I start talking about recording engineering, you know, they can't shut me up. You know, it's just like... I just get excited about it, and when the students come through the way they are, you know, it's just really good. And I'm teaching another class that has to do with copyrights and publishing and stuff like that. So that's been good as well.
Yeah, nice.
You know, although I'm probably more suited to just recording engineering than anything else, because it's all I've done for the past 4.5 decades.
Yep.
So you know.
Yep.
But that's what I've been doing. I've been really, really busy, and you know, and my sleep pattern is all whacked because there's, you know, like I'll have a late class, you know, and then I'll have an early class the next morning, you know. So by the time Sunday rolls around, where I don't have anything to do on Sunday, I'm just out cold, you know. So
nice.
So today I had a busy day today. I had two classes today.
Yep.
And I'm taking Metrolink to get there and back, so that's really good.
Right.
So I don't have to drive, and because I'm such an old fart, I get the half price, you know.
Train ticket.
You know.
Yep.
Yeah. I get the old man price, you know, so that's good.
And is it a long commute?
It's about an hour. Well, by the time... So first I have to take Metrolink, which you and I have been on together.
Yes.
Right? We have to take Metrolink. I take it from Buena Park to downtown LA, and then from there I take the subway to North Hollywood.
Right.
So if you count the time it takes to transfer from one train to the other, it's like an hour and a half each way.
Okay.
And it'd be the same if I drove. So it's, you know, so I may as well not drive and save my car the wear and tear, especially since I get the old fart rate.
Exactly. Do you know what? I'm in exactly the same boat. I have a beautiful motorbike, and in Australia, well, certainly in New South Wales, lane filtering is legal. I don't think you guys have legalized that yet, have you, in California?
Lane filtering?
That's where the motorbikes are allowed to travel in between the lines of vehicles.
Oh, yeah. They let them do that here, and I think it's crazy.
Well, you know, as a motorcyclist, I'll argue that there are good reasons for allowing it. But anyway, but just beside that, I'm in exactly the same
boat.
But
I'm surprised a lot of people on motorbikes aren't killed, you know, because people changing lanes and not paying attention and stuff like that. I mean, it must be dangerous.
Look, as a motorcyclist, you learn to have eyes in the back of your head all of the time. You know, and I live by the theory that I want to be looking at least four cars ahead of where I'm at and watching what people are doing and looking for patterns. And honestly, Doc, you become so attuned to the way people drive their vehicles, even when they're complete strangers, that you see things before they even happen. I can be riding along, look at a car four cars ahead of me and go, that guy's about to change into the right-hand lane and he's probably not going to indicate. And within 5 seconds, he's done exactly that. You just become that locked into it. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'm in exactly the same boat as you in the sense that if I ride from here in Gosford where I live, which is, you know, a good hour north of Sydney, to get to the ABC studios takes me about an hour 20. But if I ride my motorbike from here to Gosford Station, which is a, you know, an 8-minute ride, and then jump on a train, it takes me about an hour and a half. And honestly, that 10-minute time saving is not worth the stress, the added risk, the wear and tear, the fuel.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm just better off to just say, stuff it. I'll take the train. And, you know, if I want to have a sleep, I can have a sleep. If I want to read a book, I can read a book. You know,
so have you become part of a train family yet? You know,
what's a train family?
Well, because people tend to always ride at the same time and sit in the same place. Oh. So after a while, you get to know some of these people.
No,
and I've made some great friendships on the train that way. Right. In fact, I met a guy named Ken who's a euphonium player. He's in a very large 70-piece wind ensemble here.
Whoa.
And he's really a good musician. He's really good, you know. And I've met him, and through him, I've met a lot of other musicians of that ilk who are really good, high-quality, literate musicians, you know, that play a different style than, you know, guitar players, you know. And it's just been really great to do that. So, yes, train families exist because people instinctually form groups, right? So,
right. Well, here in New South Wales, they have introduced this interesting concept, and it's only on the intercity trains. It's not on the suburban trains. And mainly during peak hours, where our trains are 8 carriages long, and each carriage will hold somewhere in the vicinity of 120 people. The first car, the fourth car, the fifth car, and the eighth car are designated as quiet carriages, which means you don't talk, you put your phone on silent, and basically it's a quiet zone. If you want to talk, you travel in one of the other four cars.
Well, Metrolink has that, but they only do it with one car out of like 5 or 6.
Right. You know? Okay. Yeah. So I tend to travel in the quiet cars, and I just put my earbuds in and I'll listen to a podcast or something like that. So, so no, I haven't been the social type on the train. Yeah.
Well, people get all medieval, you know, if you make noise in their quiet car. Let
oh,
me tell
yeah,
you,
they man. Do. They do.
It's very funny.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So there's going to be some recording of 70-piece wind ensembles in your future, I would imagine?
Oh, I've been doing that for a few years.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
And I really enjoy it. So when I do it at the college, you know, I can hang a lot of microphones. And when I do it at one of their live gigs, I don't hang as many mics.
Right.
Because, you know, it's just too much.
Yep.
But, you know, the recordings turn out great. Altaverb is a good thing.
So before we go down the path of mics, what's the physical layout of a 70-piece wind ensemble look like?
Well, they might have like 6 flutes. They might have, I don't know, maybe 8 clarinets, a couple of bass clarinets, maybe a couple of bassoons, a piccolo, a couple of oboes. They might have 6 or 7 bones. They might have a bass trombone or two, 3 or 4 French horns, 4 or 5 tubas, 3 or 4 percussionists, you know, with kettle drums and snare and cymbals and all that happy stuff.
So how does this differ from an orchestra per se?
Well, it's just like recording an orchestra, except it's all wind instruments.
So there's no violins or violas or cellos or... And right. It's no stringed instruments.
That's correct. So okay. it's like one of the groups I record is called the Symphonic Winds of the Pacific, and they're just fantastic musicians.
Yeah, right.
And I love doing that. In fact, if you go to their website, Symphonic Winds of the Pacific, there's an album on there that I did. It's called A New Dawn.
Okay.
Which I recorded a few years back with them. And that was recorded at the school, so I was able to use a lot of microphones.
Right.
And that was good. And it's just really nice. And, sometimes it's great just to record a bunch of acoustic instruments, and a set of samples and, gated snares and all this stuff, although I like that too, but it's nice. And it keeps my ears sharper.
Yeah, right.
And I've learned a lot from doing it. I've learned about composers I didn't even know about.
Yeah, right.
Like there's one composer they play a lot of. Her name is Julie Giroux, and she's an amazing composer. There's a guy named Sparkle. His last name is Sparkle. I wasn't familiar with these composers before I started recording this group, and the music is just great. So I'm enjoying that a lot.
Wow. Okay, so let's talk miking. What's your general approach to that?
Well, some of it is surprising. Like, for example, one of my favorite all-around microphones for a dynamic mic is a Sennheiser MD421 into the black things.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, they have that M and S switch where the connector plugs in. And M is theoretically the flattest the microphone will get. And S stands for speech. And the more you go toward S on this switch, the more roll-off you get on the bottom. But even when this microphone is set completely to M, it still has a mid-range, upper mid-range boost, and it still has some low-end roll-off.
Okay.
So this is going to be a surprise after having said that. And it's a cardioid mic, by the way.
Yep.
And having said that, it's great on timpani. And you wouldn't think so with that low-end roll-off that it has.
Actually, that doesn't surprise me because I've used 421s on toms on a rock kit, and they just excel at toms. So,
I use them on drums all the time. That's my favorite floor tom mic. I love that. I love those mics on that. And, I wasn't there, but I've always been told that Supertramp used those mics on Breakfast in America and Crime of the Century to record their toms.
Right.
And floor tom. And those are amazing sounding records,
Oh, absolutely.
Ken Scott did that first one, the Crime of the Century. And that record was so good, we used to use it at Wally Heider's to tune our rooms.
Nice.
That's how good that record is. Don't tell any of our class clients that, right?
So where would you place 421s for this wind ensemble?
Well, I would use them when I use them on timpani, I just use one mic. There's five timpani drums, and I just basically put it over the percussionist's head a couple of feet.
Yep.
So it's probably about 6 feet away, pointing straight down into the center of all these timpani drums.
Yep.
And the leakage is very controllable because the mic doesn't really pick up a lot from the sides. It's got a very tight cardioid pattern.
Yep.
And because of that mid-range boost, it really does pick up the attack of the timpani drums. But unlike a Shure microphone, it doesn't have that edge. So it's very smooth sounding.
Right.
And then on brass, I also like Sennheiser MD441s. That's my favorite trumpet mic.
Okay.
And I use that a lot. And on trombones, I like to use RE20s, Electro Voice RE20s.
Yep.
But over the conductor's head, I have an XY pair of Neumann KM184s because I like those condensers there.
Yep.
And I like the small diaphragm condenser for that.
So are they cardioid?
If I don't have those mics, they are cardioid.
Right.
Because they're KM184s. They have the cardioid capsule because it's a body in a capsule.
Yep.
And then last time I recorded them, there was a piano off to the left. No, off to the right. So I just put a single mic on the piano, and that was a Neumann TLM-103,
nice.
Which is a little bright, but it sounded good because I was backed away a little bit because I wasn't trying to pick up the hammers too much. It wasn't a Jerry Lee Lewis session, right?
Yep.
And no compression because it wasn't that kind of date.
Yep.
And then, for flutes and stuff like that and clarinets, I usually use a variety, sometimes large diaphragm condensers, a lot of 414s. AKG 414s, yep. Especially the new 414s, the one that use the phantom power to drive the LEDs on the switches. Those microphones are unbelievably smooth as silk.
Right. They're
just fantastic. And I don't work for AKG, so in case anybody wonders. But anyway, so I use those. I typically don't use large diaphragm condensers for a distant pickup,
Right.
I use small diaphragm condensers for that.
So what's the thinking there? Why do you differentiate between large and small diaphragm for distance recording?
Well, my experience tells me that if I'm going to pick up something that's, you know, 20 or 30 feet away, I'm going to do get a better job on it with a small diaphragm condenser. It's going to attenuate high frequencies less over a distance, in my opinion.
Fair enough.
Okay. French horns. You know, last time I recorded them, I used U47 FETs on the French horns. I have a couple that I use. Actually, I only have one because I sold one on eBay, but I've got one now.
Right.
And I've got a few U87s. I have one that I own, and the school has a couple, and I use those in various places, you know, for stuff.
Yep.
I usually pick up the bassoons. And anybody who's sitting near the bassoons, like the bass clarinets, I usually pick up those with whatever I have left, but I'm looking for a large diaphragm condenser for those. And I'm probably 4 to 6 feet away with these mics. So I'm using the leakage. So for those of you out there listening to this, leakage isn't always bad. If you don't have leakage on recording this kind of music, it doesn't sound right. You have to have leakage.
Yeah.
But the key is to use microphones that don't sound bad when they get leakage from the sides or back.
Right.
Different microphones sound different when you get off axis, right?
Yep.
So I think that answers the question.
Well, I guess the leakage in that particular environment would actually help to gel the whole mix together, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's one thing that I do. And I think most engineers do this, but I think I may have mentioned this before in terms of drum overheads, because drum overheads are the same way. But when I mix this stuff, I'll bring up the XY pair over the conductor first, and I'll just listen and hear in my mind's eye where the instruments lay out, you know, in terms of panning.
Yep.
And then I'll make sure that I pan the spot mics to exactly the same location. So there's no kind of weird phasey stuff going on because things aren't panned the same.
Right.
I'm very careful about that. And I do the same with drum overheads versus tom-toms.
Nice. You know?
So monocompatibility is approved, and the imaging is much better when you take the time to do that.
Yeah.
So if you have an oboe and it's just left of center, which is typical, you better make sure if you have a spot mic there, that it's also in the same place, for example.
Yep. Yeah, that makes sense.
Otherwise, when they play soft or loud, what can happen if you don't do that is the image can shift.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Because your spot mic is likely to pick up the softer part of the performance more than the distance mic would.
Yeah, that's right. And if the panning doesn't match, it'll move in the stereo field.
Wow, I'd never considered that idea, but that totally makes sense.
Yeah, it's subtle.
Yeah,
you know, subtle. When I'm teaching the students about this, they don't hear it until I point it out, and then they hear it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
you
know, I kind of came upon it by myself. Nobody taught me that, you know. Yep. So if it's wrong, it's my fault.
Totally. Well, I tell you, in theory, I can absolutely understand why you would take that approach, because the way you've described it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So how many inputs would you generally be recording for something like that?
Somewhere between like 20 and 24,
right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
That's enough microphones for a big wind ensemble, like 70 pieces. That's you know, it's funny, but sometimes the more musicians you have, the less mics you need.
Right.
Drums are the same way. You know, the more toms you have, the more you depend on the overheads.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, you can't spot mic everything.
Right.
It just gets crazy.
You know, so, you know, in today's world, everything is pinned too hot, but it wasn't that way back when I had brown hair.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Although I feel like the winds of change are starting to swing back on that.
Oh, God.
What?
Well, that's just an invitation to have polarity problems.
Well, it just seems that, you know, all of the streaming services are now normalizing to, you know, anything from, you know, minus 14 LUFS down, which means that absolutely smashing everything through a brick wall limiter is of no value whatsoever anymore.
Oh, no, no, no. We're talking about different stuff. I was talking about the connector polarity, pin 2 being hot, pin 3 being cold, and pin 1 being shield or ground.
Sorry. I thought when you said everything's pinned hot these days, I thought you meant like everything's slammed through a brick wall limiter. Sorry, my misunderstanding.
You know, I make sure to leave room so the mastering engineers don't bomb my house.
Yeah, yeah,
you
know? Yeah, for sure. You know? For sure.
Yeah, I don't flat top stuff, but I do use bus compression.
Yeah,
and sometimes I use parallel compression even in this style of music because it just helps
to bring up
reduce
the
dynamic
stuff.
Range so that these musicians can play it in their car and they don't have to turn it up and down all day.
Sure. Now, there's one thing I noticed and I wanted to query you on. The concept of a Decca tree is, if I understand it correctly, is where you have a mono mic that's pointed dead straight over the conductor's head as well as a stereo pair. But you mentioned that you just use a stereo pair of KM-184s. What's the advantage to that third mic that's mono and pointed straight ahead, and why don't you do it?
Well, you know, I just don't use Decca tree because I just haven't had an opportunity to use it that much, and it takes time to set up. But I'll tell you, when I was working earlier in my career, Bruce Botnick, who's an amazing engineer, would come in with Jerry Goldsmith, you know.
Wow.
And he would use the Decca tree a lot. And nobody gets a better sound than Bruce Botnick. I'm
right.
Just flat out going to say it. Just, you know, it's impossible to steal a client from him.
So this is orchestral scores for movie soundtracks?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And Bruce did a demo of some of his scoring tracks at Westlake Audio, which is a store near here.
Yep.
And the sound of the bass trombones he got was so good. It was so good. I had to basically grab him and tell him, you know, how good it was. And, you know, he has a rack of 2 mic preamps, that, at least he did, that he would bring. And he's that rare quality of a gentleman and a perfectionist and yet a realist, so he doesn't waste a lot of time. He's just great.
Yeah, right.
So Bruce uses the Decca tree.
Right.
And I don't, but I probably should. But I just, you know, I'm a creature of habit.
Sure, sure. I just wondered if maybe you'd tried it at one stage and had, you know, disliked it for some reason, or that's why I asked you, so...
No, I don't dislike it at all, no.
But it is interesting that you should mention Westlake Audio, because only yesterday, 24 hours ago, I was sitting down watching the live stream on YouTube for the launch of iZotope's RX7, the new version of their, you know, forensic audio suite, if you like. And they were doing
right.
it from Westlake Audio.
That's great. I use RX.
Oh, it's great. Yeah,
I use it, but I don't. I use RX3. You know, I'm kind of late. You know,
right.
on my upgrades.
So, man, you want to see some of the stuff they've brought out in 7? They've brought out. I can't remember what the name of the tool was, but basically, there's this tool where you can change the inflection of a spoken word in post.
Wow!
Yeah.
I like it.
Wow, absolutely wow. It was phenomenal to watch this guy demonstrate it. It was a guy called David Bach. I don't know if that name means anything to you.
Well, yeah, Bach microphones.
No, not Dave Bach. Bach. Not Bach, Bach, B-A-C-H.
Oh, Bach. Oh, B-A-C-H, okay.
But this guy had done some Foley and location recording stuff for some fairly major motion pictures. I didn't know if it was a name you'd come across. He might be a little after your time.
I don't know him, but, you know, if he's working there at Westlake or if he's working for Westlake and iZotope, he must have his chops together. So
yeah.
I don't know the guy.
Yeah, so he was demonstrating it, and it was pretty cool.
One of the great things about RX, the way I use it, well, it's like 5 different software
yeah.
packages, you know, and one of them is Spectral Repair, and that is just fantastic.
Yes.
I haven't looked to see if they've screwed that up with the newest version yet, but, you know, I hopefully they haven't, because I use that all the time to get rid of air conditioning noise.
Yep.
And, you know, like if I'm doing it like an orchestral thing and somebody turns a page and is too close to the microphone or there's a cough in there, you know, I can take that out 100%.
Yep.
It's just amazing.
So, like you, I was on 3, and then about probably 6 or 8 months ago, I took the plunge and bought 6 advanced. So these days they have standard and they have advanced, and advanced has a whole bunch of extra tools. And not only is there still spectral repair, which works just as well as it did in 3, but they also have what they call ambience match. And this basically allows you to take, it's almost like spectral repair in reverse, in that you can find a piece of ambience from the room. And if you've got another piece of dialogue, like maybe some ADR that had to be recorded in a, you know, a quiet studio, and you need that to match the location vocal, you can then use this ambience match, and it will take the fingerprint of the ambience of the room and paste it underneath your ADR track, so that the ambience is matched through the whole performance between the location recording and the ADR recording.
Wow. So it's got like an Altiverb-y kind of component to it.
I don't know Altiverb. What does that do?
It's a convolution reverb.
Oh, okay.
So it mimics, you know, locations.
Sure, sure.
They must have something like that in this plugin, you know.
I guess so, yeah. It's pretty amazing. It's really cool.
You should
cool.
check out Altiverb. It's the only reverb you'll ever need, you know?
Well, you see, Reaper has a convolution reverb built in as well.
Oh, great.
Reaper does not come with impulses. It's up to you to find your own impulses.
Oh, Altiverb comes with a big library, you know, like Berlin Philharmonic, you know, and Lexicon 224s and AMS RMX 16s. And,
nice.
You know, great. It's just...
Yeah.
Great. I use it a lot.
But if you've got the Waves, any of the Waves bundles, like Gold or Upwards, you get the IR reverb, which is a convolution reverb as well. And that comes with quite a few impulses built in. And there are additional impulses that you can download for free from Waves once you've got an account there. So I've done that as well. But to be honest, I hardly ever use it. I've got the convolution reverb in Reaper, and I've got a whole bunch of, you know, impulses that I've sourced from all over the web, and I tend to just use those a lot.
Well, I haven't, you know, I'm aware that Waves does that.
Yep.
But I haven't really worked very much with it to get familiar with it, you know, because I haven't needed to, because I have the other software, but I'm sure it's very good. You know, they make good plugins. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure it's very good. I just haven't, you know, I've just been elsewhere. What can I say? I've been using something else.
Oh, I'll have to check out Altiverb.
Lately, I've been kind of adding to my collection of Sound Toys plugins.
Oh, okay. Yep.
They have a lot of plugins that I really like. They have one called Echo Boy, which is pretty much the only delay plugin I ever need.
Right.
You know?
It's interesting that you mentioned Sound Toys, because, again, it was only yesterday that I was on Facebook and I saw someone talking about Waves, and then someone came back and was just absolutely full of hatred for Waves and was saying, oh, you know, I hate Waves and the fact that you've got to keep on paying for the same plugins that you already paid for and you don't get any upgrade to it. Blah, blah, blah. And one of the, you know, other vendors that he said, you know, you should definitely check out was Sound Toys. And I went and had a look at their collection of stuff, and they've got some really nice looking plugins.
Well, as I understand it, and I could be wrong because I didn't hear this from the horse's mouth, but as I understand it, Sound Toys was started with the original people from Eventide Clockworks. That's what
I've
been
told.
Is that
right?
And that would explain a lot about the high quality of their products.
Yeah, now, right.
Getting back to Waves, I do believe they have modified their renewal program to be less of a problem for people that don't want to do that.
Yes.
Don't quote me, though, because I'm not a big Waves user, but I do have some Waves plugins that I use. I have their API package, the automated processes, and I have the Solid State Logic package, and I use both of those a lot.
Yeah, I love their SSLG channel plugin.
Yeah, I do too.
Love that thing.
Yeah, I use it all the time.
Yep.
It's great.
And the G Masterbus compressor pretty much lives on my 2-bus on just about every project I mix.
Yes, well...
It's a nice compressor.
I use it a lot, but I also have a Neve hardware. Let me make sure I get the model number right. Now, this is hardware.
Right.
It's a 33609J.
Right.
And this thing is modeled by UA. They know their plugins have a model of this.
Right.
And so I don't have a hardware of the SSL bus compressor, but I do have the same plugin that you have, and I do like it a lot.
Yep.
Sometimes, though, I have to use this hardware because there's something about analog hardware that
interesting. Just
very nice.
Right. I really should do that more. You know, I should try using my hardware compressor for mixes just to see whether I could actually hear the difference.
Yeah, try running through it with the compression off and see if it makes any difference as well.
Well, you see, mine doesn't have transformers in it. Mine's just purely transistor-based, but...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure this Neve has transformers in it, you know, because it's pretty old. You know, I think it was probably not designed under Rupert's auspices, but probably not long after he left.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Nice.
Now, we were going to talk today. Last time you and I had a conversation, or last time we were on the air, we were going to talk about metering and DBM and all and DBU and all that stuff. We can still do that if you want, or we can save it to next time.
Maybe Let's
we
got to save it till next time. We'll save it till next time because, I feel like I should.
Because that'll be dry, man. That'll anybody who's listening, that'll just, if they're having trouble sleeping, that'll take care of it. Right there.
Exactly. It's funny, you know, because I've been 3-4 weeks at the ABC now, and one of the things that's come up has been mastering levels for promos. I've asked the question, I've said, look, you know, what's the standard that you want here? You know, you tell me what it is, I'll mix to it. And the problem is there's no consistency between the various networks on the ABC. So the guys on Classic FM will mix to one level. The guys on News Radio will mix to another level. The guys on local radio will mix to another level. It's like, guys, get it together. It's not that hard.
Oh man.
So they're actually, I was talking to one of the other engineers, like, you know, one of the other promo producers, and he was saying, oh mate, this comes up every 12 months, he said, and they'll talk about it and they'll rattle their sabers for a few weeks and then it'll all die down again and everyone will go back to doing their own thing again. It's like, oh, seriously? So, because initially, you know, someone said to me, oh, mix for minus 18 luffs and you'll be right. And then someone else said, oh no, mix for minus 23 luffs. And then someone else said, oh yeah, minus 18 RMS. And it's like, oh geez, make up your mind.
Well, you know, if you're going to mix analog equipment with digital, then it makes sense to have your nominal be at minus 18 because that's around zero VU, which is what analog equipment wants to see.
Yep.
You know, they don't want to see a really hot level coming in, you know, like 10 dB above zero. No. They don't want to see that.
Exactly.
And people tend to do that because they're using full-scale digital meters, you know, zero dB full scale. That's a complete, we're moving into the wrong podcast.
We are. We should just let it go and we'll make a whole episode about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. God. Well, mate, been good to chat.
Yes, very funny. Always.
So what do you got on your plate for the next few weeks? Have you got any projects coming up you're looking forward to?
Well, I've been recording a couple of groups that I really like, and I've completed those projects.
Nice.
And in fact, I owe you a track because you asked me to send you a track that had my mix and then the version after it was mastered. Do you remember that?
That's right, yes.
And I haven't done it only because I have the band's on the road and I haven't been able to get their permission to send it to you.
Right. No worries.
And you know how I am about intellectual property security. I take it extremely seriously.
Definitely. Definitely.
You know, as do you. Yep. And it's just something that you don't compromise on if you're a professional. And if you care about right and wrong, you just don't compromise that.
That's right. Yep.
And companies have gone out of business because they were a little loose there with that.
Right.
It has driven companies under.
Yep.
If something gets out that shouldn't get out, other clients stay away after that because they don't want to have the same fate happening to them.
Exactly.
But as soon as I do get a hold of the band, I will send it to you.
Okay, awesome.
All right.
Thank you.
It doesn't mean we can play it in this podcast,
no.
But maybe we can, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, link it to in the show notes or whatever. But that all depends on what the band wants me to do.
For sure. And, but no, I'd love to hear a before and after mastering. That'd be great.
It's not that different, happily.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Which says that you did the mix really well.
Well, it says that my Genelecs are fairly accurate, but you know, I think he did add a tad mid-range because I think my Genelecs might be just a little soft around the crossover frequency, which I think is 2K on these guys.
Right.
And that would be not unusual, and that would explain it. But I love these speakers. I can listen to them all day long at a comfortable level because I don't monitor real loud once I can have tones.
Same, you know? Same. I don't monitor loud at all.
Yeah. I do when I'm getting sounds, like, you know,
yeah,
guitar sounds and drum sounds. But after that, you could talk. We can have a conversation while I'm mixing, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, because if it sounds good soft, it's only going to sound better loud.
That's right. Which is not always the same in reverse.
No, it's not the same in reverse. If you have to have a mix loud to make it sound good, it's not really in the mix.
Yeah.
For those of you radio listeners out there, Google Fletcher Munson curves.
Absolutely.
And that will explain a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And you and I have had this conversation many times.
We have. Yeah. We have. All right, Doc, good to chat, mate.
Always.
You look
always
after yourself.
You too, man. Let me keep me in the loop.
Definitely. Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sign language. Another audiotoyou.com quality podcast. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@signlanguagepodcast.com.